This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Fran Lebowitz, has turned talking into her art form and her profession. In a way, she's like a brilliant comic who's very funny, but doesn't tell jokes. Her style comes from being a writer who can no longer write. After writing columns for Andy Warhol's magazine Interview and two very popular collections of humorous essays, Metropolitan Life in 1978 and Social Studies in 1981, she developed a now famous case of writer's block. That's a loss for readers, but a win for people who get to see her on stage in conversation. Now you can see her in conversation in a new Netflix documentary series called Pretend It's a City. It's a series of interviews with her, mostly conducted by her friend Martin Scorsese, who also directed the series. In 2010, he directed an HBO documentary about Lebowitz that also featured her in conversation, called Public Speaking. In the new series, Lebowitz talks about many subjects, including growing up in New Jersey with parents who raised her to be a wife and mother, what's happened to New York City since she moved there after dropping out of high school in the late 60s, working as a New York City cab driver when she was in her 20s, writing for Andy Warhol's Interview magazine in her 20s, why she owns over 10,000 books, and why she still doesn't own a cell phone or computer. As the series editor David Tedeschi put it, the new series, Pretend It's a City, is about what Fran has to say, but it's also about how she says it. It's about her timing, her cadence, her pace. Fran Lebowitz, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you.
The series was shot before COVID, so you don't get to talk about the pandemic in the series. But I'm interested in hearing, how's your fear level about contagion, and how vigilant have you been about not getting COVID?
I think I've been excellent at not getting COVID because I have not gotten it. I think that's the proof that I've been vigilant. I've been like really careful, but I kind of was astonished that I didn't get it before we knew about it, because up until like March, I think New York shut down on March 13th. March 12th, I did an event at the Strand with Ben Ketcher. So nobody was in more swarms of people than I was before it happened. Millions of people on the subway, in the street, in restaurants, and museums. But since then, I've had to have a few tests to do certain things. And I have to say, I wasn't very worried that I had it. I don't know why. But I mean, every time someone called to tell me I was negative, I mean, the first time, the line producer of the Pretend It's a City called, and he said, I got your test results, you're negative. I said, I knew that, Josh. And he said, how did you know that? And I said, because my entire life people have been saying to me, Fran, you're so negative. So I was aware that I would be negative. I am still negative.
Are you predisposed to worrying about health and infection?
You know, I've always been very, I know what the word is, very careful about touching things. For instance, I can and have thousands of times, I've never touched a single thing in the New York City subway system, ever. And usually I'm by myself on the subway, but a few times, I remember many years ago, going on the subway with someone, and he said to me, when we got out, he said, you didn't touch anything. And I said, no. And the truth is, if I dropped the Hope Diamond on the floor of a subway car, I'd leave it there. I say, well, you know, it's just the Hope Diamond. But I have seen, I mean, I of course seen people pick things up from this floor. I at least once was sitting across from a woman with a baby, and I forget what you call the pacifier, fell out of the baby's mouth. The woman picked it up, wiped it off on her shirt, and put it back in the baby's mouth. I really thought one of two things is going to happen to that baby. Either he's going to drop dead right now, or he'll live to be a million years old, because he's just been exposed to every germ and virus on the planet Earth.
You've always lived alone by choice. How is living alone feeling during the pandemic when everybody's feeling kind of isolated?
Well, it's still, you know, seems to me to be by far the best choice. I cannot understand how people who do not live alone have stood this last 10 months, you know, because the only upside of, you know, being, you know, having to stay in my apartment is at least there was no one else there. I mean, I would find that unbearable. I mean, truly unbearable. So there are people that I know at the very beginning, this guy I know, this friend of mine sent me, you know, like $1 million worth of orchids, saying, these are to keep you company. And I thought, really? I mean, thank you. They're beautiful. But I keep myself company.
Do you ever get lonely?
You know, truthfully, I really have never get lonely. I mean, I certainly can say that there are specific people that I've missed in my life numerous times, you know, some very grievously. But a kind of abstract loneliness, no.
This new series is the second time Scorsese has documented you as a public speaker. Your friends, how did you become friends with Scorsese?
You know, neither Marty nor I really know. I always say that, you know, I must have met Marty at a party because I can't think where else I would have met him. And also because I've spent, you know, so much of my life going to parties, and Marty has gone to fewer parties, hence Marty has made more movies than Fran has written books. But, you know, I feel like I did notice at some point that whenever I saw Marty at a party, I would spend most of the evening talking to Marty. We both have such a strong connection to New York that, in fact, when I made my deal with Marty for public speaking, we had the meeting. When the meeting was over, Marty said, okay, here's the deal. We don't leave Manhattan. And we shook hands, and that was a deal. We never had any kind of contract or anything. So in Pretend It's a City, we did go to Queens. Something Marty talked about as if we were going to Afghanistan. Remember, we have to go to Queens, friend. Queens. You know where this place is? And even though, of course, Marty has made movies all over the world, you know, he doesn't take to that kindly, having to leave New York. And for instance, like, I happen not to have left New York for maybe a month before the shutdown. So I actually have not left New York for almost a year.
So you were kind of different as a kid when you were growing up. You wanted to go your own way. You had your own thoughts. You've always been yourself, and yourself is often oppositional and unique. Did that bother you ever as a kid that you didn't? I mean, you're such a paradox. Like, on the one hand, you always go your own way. You ended up being president of one of your high school classes. That struck me as so odd, because I can't imagine you being interested in student government, even though I know you follow politics now, but that's different than student government. And so, like, you're the president of one of your classes, and then you're expelled from the school. It's like one paradox after another. Explain.
Well, I mean, the difference is that the kids elected me president, and the headmaster threw me out.
Got it. Yes, that's a good explanation.
I mean, this class I was the president of had literally 12 people in it. Okay, so I could believe I could be the president of the United States if there are only 12 people in the United States. I wasn't interested in student government. This is a private girls' school that I went to for like 15 minutes before they threw me out. So that's where I was elected president. And then the headmaster of that school threw me out. The official reason he threw me out was, he said, I was a terrible influence on the other girls and I was usurping his power. Whatever that meant, I have no idea. But I don't know what kind of power. I mean, it's kind of a sad thing that the headmaster of a girls' school thinks he has a lot of power, but and that's what happened. So I always felt that I was punished for things unfairly. In other words, like, I didn't do. In other words, when I got thrown out of school, for years afterward, people say, "What did you do?" And I know I was expected to say, you know, I started a revolution. You know, I set fire to the gym. But I really didn't do anything. And I really think that what I got expelled for was what my mother used to call that look on your face.
So, as in, wipe that look off of your face?
Yes, wipe that look off your face. So I think, and by the way, I was unaware of this look on my face. So that you know, it's like people very often say to me, you never smile in photographs. Why don't you smile? And I always say, I think I am smiling. Why are you sneering? I think I'm smiling. So that there is some kind of disconnect between apparently the way I look and the way I think I feel. You know, yes, there's this paradox, you know, I've never had the experience of being so in the control of other people once I got out of school.
When you came to New York when you were in your teens, you wanted to be a writer and you became a writer. But before you had like a best-selling book, you had jobs like driving a taxi and cleaning houses, cleaning apartments maybe.
Yeah, apartments.
Yeah, I want to hear about driving a taxi because you were how old? You were still in your teens?
I would say, you know, I don't remember exactly. I could have been 20, 21, you know.
Yeah.
And
this is in the 70s at a time when there were very few women driving a taxi. And there still are few women driving a taxi, but it was fewer then. And you were very young. Were you ever, like, in physical danger?
Well, I mean, New York was very dangerous, period, then. You know, say it was like 1970 or 71, I don't remember. You know, it was dangerous to walk down the street. There was a tremendous amount of crime. So it was considered dangerous. I drove a taxi because I don't have any skills. You know, I didn't know how to do anything else. I knew how to drive because I was from New Jersey, so I knew how to drive. I knew how to clean a house because my mother trained me to clean houses. That was pretty much it, skill-wise. So I also didn't want to do the job that most of my friends did, which was wait tables, because, you know, I didn't want to have to be nice to men to get tips or to sleep with the manager of my shift, which was a common requirement then for being a waitress in New York. I didn't want to have a boss, which you don't in either one of those jobs. The cab driving as a profession was completely different than it is now because there were these garages with big fleets. There would be like someone would own like, you know, 40 cabs or maybe more. So you could pick up a cab any shift. You could always make money. So that if you woke up in your apartment with no money, a frequent occurrence in my life, I could go pick up a cab at the end of 8 hours. I had money. So that to me was a great thing. It was dangerous. Nothing ever happened to me in the cab. I mean, I was never had any type of, you know, attack on me or anything like that. I was pretty careful, you know, who I picked up, by which I mean it's still something I would do if I have to drive a cab again. Not impossible. You know, I would pick up any man who could be holding an assault weapon if he was with a woman. I would not pick up a bunch of guys together the same way that I will cross the street my whole life to avoid a bunch of young guys walking around together. It's not a good job for a woman. It's not, by the way, a good job. So if you're a young person listening to this, think of something else.
Is it true that you also wrote porn after you came to Manhattan?
It is true. I'm talking about books, all right? You know, someone told me about this. And someone told me they were doing this. And I don't remember anymore. But if you wrote a book for this company, you got like something like $500, which was probably at that point about a third of the amount of money I would make in a year. So this seemed like, what? This is unbelievable. And this guy who told me about it had a contract. And then I also remember seeing this. There was a piece of paper that he got from this company that told you what had to be in the book, what couldn't be in the book, what had to be in the book, how often it had to be in the book. And so this guy, like, what happened was that he just felt he couldn't do it. So he kind of farmed it out and ended up with like six of us writing this book together, and really wasn't writing. I mean, I didn't write. We just sat around like, we thought it was hilarious, by the way.
I can imagine.
One of the things you couldn't have was any kind of sex between men, but you had to have sex between women.
These to turn on men.
Yes. These books were meant for straight men. Okay.
that were this whole company, I think, was meant for this. And so I just remember sitting around. Most of the people I was with were stoned. One person I remember typing on a typewriter, not me, because I don't know how to do that. And then we had to split up the money. I think I ended up getting like $40 or something like that. But the thing that I did do that I achieved was everyone used a pseudonym. No one used their real names on these books. And I got them to use the name of the headmaster who threw me out of school. That is, in fact, to this day, one of my greatest accomplishments.
The scenes with sex between women must have been very authentic when you were writing them.
Well, these books were meant, you know, purely for straight men. So
not for lesbians. Yeah.
Yes, not for women, not for anyone else. But you know, almost all cultural production at the time was also produced for straight men.
You worked at Andy Warhol's magazine Interview. I think you got that job when you were 21. Did Andy Warhol like interview you for the position?
No. So the first time I went to interview, and I went up in the elevator, and when the elevator door opened, there was a metal door that was closed that had a piece of paper taped to it that said, "Knock loudly and announce yourself." This was after Andy had been shot. So I heard someone say, "Who is it?" And I said, "Valerie Solanas." And Andy opened the door.
Oh, God.
So in case you were thinking Andy Warhol, he was a genius. All right. So first of all, I was shocked that he opened the door. I don't know. For some reason, I never actually expected him to be there, even though it was called Andy Warhol's Interview. I didn't want to be there because of Andy. I wanted to be there because it was a magazine. So he opened the door and he didn't comment on what I said. And I said I had an appointment with the editor. And he said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a writer." Now, nobody that I knew my age wanted to be a writer. Nobody. And so this was very helpful to me, you know. But almost everyone I knew wanted to be or was a musician or a filmmaker. Writing was like not, you know, the thing people were gravitating toward. So they were having trouble getting writers. So he said, you know, "Oh, great." And I went in and I told... Now, I told the editor, I want to write movie reviews. He said, "Okay." I said, "But I want my own column." "Okay." "I want the back page." "Okay." "I only want to review bad movies." "I only want to review bad movies because I just want to be funny. I'm not a film critic." "Okay." So I had a column called The Best of the Worst. Where I just reviewed bad movies. And that's how I started an interview.
That's great. When you worked at Andy Warhol's magazine Interview, it sounds like you had like a lot of disagreements with Andy Warhol. What would you disagree about?
I didn't have a lot of disagreements with Andy because I didn't work at the factory. In other words, I didn't go there, you know, every day. There were people who worked there, you know. I mean,
right.
The interview was on one side and the factory, as we called it, was on the other side. But there were people who went to work there every day. At interview, there were the editor, there was a receptionist. But I never had a job there. I never had a job. So I didn't go there every day. I wouldn't say that I had disagreements with Andy. I would say that Andy didn't like me and that I did not like Andy.
Why didn't you like him?
Well, I noticed right away how many people around him died. I know you're not supposed to say this, you know, but I mean, mm-hmm. kids, I mean, you know, there's a tremendous amount of, encouragement of people already teetering on the brink of sanity. I mean, a lot of the people around Andy in those days were, I don't know what the thing you're supposed to say now. I'm certain you're not supposed to say crazy, but whatever you want. Let's say not the most stable people on the planet Earth. And Andy would feed these fantasies they had of themselves because it amused him. And it was also lucrative for him. And I just didn't want to be really around that. And, you know, I think that Andy realized that. Or maybe I just wasn't his cup of tea. But I didn't have arguments with Andy because I never had much conversation with Andy.
Mm-hmm. So are you referring to like drug overdoses and suicides?
Yeah, drug overdoses. Or there were a couple actual suicides. You know, I mean, these people, no one was dying of old age. These people were really young. So, and this was way before AIDS. So this was, yeah, mostly drugs.
You were close friends with Toni Morrison, and you've written about that friendship and how much you miss her now. And I think you met at a reading that you were both doing. A lot of people think that you were an odd combination because her writing sometimes had this kind of magic realism, and you're this kind of cynical, skeptical, opinionated humorist. But obviously, you had a lot of things in common. What were some of the things that you shared?
Well, Toni loved parties. Okay, so if you didn't know Toni personally, you would not know how much fun Toni was. Toni was really fun. Most of the time I spent with Toni, which was zillions of hours. I mean, I met Toni in 1978. So most of the time we were laughing. Okay. I mean, she was really fun. In fact, when I first knew Toni, she was still working at Random House as an editor. And they were at that point my publisher. And my editor called me and said, now I can't remember who was the president of Random House at the time, but he said, so-and-so called me and you have to stop hanging around in Toni Morrison's office because the people, so-and-so, whatever his name was complaining because you're hanging around in there and the two of you are laughing all the time and she's not getting her work done. So I made Toni not getting her work done, you know, I mean, it's just a ridiculous idea. So I even once, not that long ago, met a man who taught at Princeton, and Toni taught at Princeton much after this. And he said, I used to have the office next to Toni Morrison, and you and Toni Morrison really annoyed me with all your laughing. So I would say that's the probably the thing we had in common was liking to laugh.
Fran Lebowitz, it's been a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming back on our show.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
You can see Fran Lebowitz interviewed by Martin Scorsese and by Spike Lee in the new Netflix series, Pretend It's a City, which was directed by Scorsese. The bass player Joshua Abrams is a mainstay of creative music in Chicago, making many dozens of records as a sideman, leading his own band, Natural Information Society, and composing music for documentary films. His new album is a quartet Abrams brought together to play the Hyde Park Jazz Festival in 2016 before recording the next day. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says they play music in contrasting moods.
Joshua Abrams' tune, In Place of Memory, where drummer Gerald Cleaver sets a deep, slow swing groove. It's from the album Cloud Script by Abrams' chameleonic quartet of the same name, with longtime ally Jeff Parker on guitar and veteran Chicago saxophonist Ari Brown. His economical playing and brawny tenor sound fit the leader's spare themes. A couple of ballads really show the saxophonist off. This is Conjunctio, with the leader's nimble bass dancing behind. Ari Brown on tenor sax. Joshua Abrams' quartet can groove and play pretty, but they all like free jazz too, and a couple of pieces get exuberantly ornery. Guitarist Jeff Parker can get down and dirty within the ensemble fabric rather than strutting out in front. Jeff Parker does some very creative work in the backgrounds. At one point, he accompanies Ari Brown's tenor with clangy guitar harmonics, obstinate but somehow right, like Thelonious Monk's piano bombs behind a horn. Joshua Abrams' main band, Natural Information Society, plays long, hypnotic jams inspired by Moroccan trance music. That influence comes out on Harbor. Repetitive music takes another kind of discipline, but these four players catch that wave too. That bowed bass is notably low in the mix. Most leaders like to put a little more me in there. That ego-free sound balance is typical of Joshua Abrams, a sign the music on CloudScript is less about him than the collective. It's about being part of something bigger, where each player is stronger for all the ways they interlock.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed CloudScript, the new album by bassist Joshua Abrams Quartet. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. I'll let him introduce it.
The protests for racial justice that swept through the country last year found support among many Americans, and they also reignited old debates about how militant activists should be and how far they should go in seeking social change. Are peaceful marches the best approach, or is mass civil disobedience, even violence, called for? Do demands like defunding the police turn off potential allies and undermine prospects for reform? Historian Carrie Greenidge has a book about an African-American activist and newspaper editor of another era. He fought uncompromising battles for civil rights in the early 20th century, at times earning the scorn of black leaders committed to more gradual, reformist approaches to change. His name was William Monroe Trotter, and while running his weekly newspaper, The Guardian, in Boston for decades, he organized massed protests, confronted presidents, and pressed hard for federal laws to stop lynchings and to ensure the voting rights and full citizenship promised African Americans after the Civil War. Greenidge's book is a gripping read, an account of Trotter's life and of African American activism in the Jim Crow era. Carrie Greenidge is an assistant professor in the Department of Studies in Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University. Her book, Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter, was published last year. It's out in paperback this week. She joins me from her office at Tufts. Carrie Greenidge, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I had never heard of William Monroe Trotter, probably like a lot of our audience. Sounds like he was about as prominent as Martin Luther King in his day. And I read in the acknowledgments, you first heard the name from your grandfather. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, thank you first for the introduction, and I'm so happy to be here. I grew up in New England. I was born in Brooklyn, but I'm a, you know, Black New England person. My family has been here for, you know, generations, and both of my maternal grandparents were activists during the 1950s and 1960s in the South End of Boston. And by the time I was born, my family had moved to the suburbs, and my grandparents were still involved in activist work in the 70s and into the 80s in Boston, despite the fact that they lived in the suburbs. And so I can remember very, very clearly being sick, being in my grandparents' home in a suburb of Boston. And my grandfather was watching the television and he saw a retrospective on TV about busing in Boston. One of those sort of anniversaries of the horrible time in 1974 when the city of Boston erupted in protests over court-ordered desegregation of the public schools. And he was watching this. And I remember him just saying as an aside, kind of probably just to himself, that if William Monroe Trotter was there, none of this would have happened. And I remember immediately thinking, well, who is that person? And getting up and asking, going to my grandmother, and my grandmother writing it down on a piece of paper for me, the name, and showing me a book that came out in the late 1960s, early 70s, called The Guardian of Boston. And she showed me the book, and she said that Trotter was a race man. This is sort of an old term that older Black people often use to refer to activists of a different generation. And she said he was a race man and that he was an activist. And I sort of stored that in my memory. And then when I went to college and went to grad school, I began to wonder what had happened to Trotter and why it was that our understanding of him as scholars and really the consciousness we have about Black protest, why it was that the story that was told about him seemed to lack depth, the story being that he was secondary to the freedom struggle. And so that's really where I came to approach Trotter before I even went to graduate school.
And you found a really deep and interesting story. You know, when Trotter was active in the early 20th century, in some ways like now, it was a time when many African Americans felt an urgent sense of needed social change. And people didn't always agree on how to get there. That's a lot of what we read in the book. Your book was written before George Floyd's tragic death and the demonstrations that followed. But as you researched this, were you thinking about activism and what lessons this would offer for how to pursue social change?
Well, yes, I was really thinking and approaching, as I try to do with all of my work, what it is that politically shapes a community, specifically African and African descended people. How do people come by the politics that they have? And specifically, this whole idea of the Black radical tradition, which is this long tradition in the Atlantic world. And so how do people come to embrace that? And why is it that communities often valorize those people once they are gone? But during their lives, those people are often marginalized in the public consciousness. And so I was really thinking of it from that end and thinking of it from a protest end, but also taking this idea that radical protest is not simply for a changing of laws, although Trotter definitely believed in that. It's really for a reconceptualization by Black people themselves on how they see their power in the world. And so I really wanted to sort of go deeply into this community, go deeply into Trotter and how it is that Trotter was galvanizing a community that most people, including some leaders of the community, thought of as having very little political power.
Yeah, you know, Trotter spoke to working and poor Black citizens, organizing them, wanting them to feel the power they held with coordinated mass action. But he himself was among the wealthiest and best educated Black people in Boston. Tell us a little about his background.
Oh, sure. So William Monroe Trotter was born in 1872. He's born in Chillicothe, Ohio. His father, James Monroe Trotter, was a lieutenant, one of only a handful of Black lieutenants in the Union Army. His mother was born between the family farm in southern Ohio and the slave state of Virginia, and his father, James Monroe Trotter, for his exploits in the Civil War, was awarded a position as head of the Federal Post Office in Boston, and moved to Boston in 1868, and Trotter was born in 1872. And so he grew up in a household that was decidedly upper middle class. His father was also a writer and a music promoter, and his father eventually was appointed to Recorder of Deeds in Washington, D.C. by President Grover Cleveland in the 1880s. So Trotter came from a lifestyle, a childhood of much privilege. And he graduated from high school, grew up in a predominantly white area of what is now Hyde Park in Boston, but back then was a suburb, and attended Harvard University. He was a brilliant student, never ranked below third in his class, graduated in 1895, got an inheritance from his father that was worth about $20,000, and in today's money, that's a stupendous amount of money, and really was content to become a real estate broker, but then began to see that the ways in which racism, particularly entrenched institutionalized racism of the 1890s, prevented that from happening. He was one of the most prominent and popular students at Harvard's campus, yet he couldn't get a job anywhere with his Harvard degree. His father had known all of these directors of like the National Bank of Commerce and white liberal bigwigs in Massachusetts, and he couldn't get them to call him back. And so Trotter really began to reevaluate and look at what did it mean to be, quote unquote, a successful black man at a time when that success really bore a little material rewards due to the racial structures that existed. And so he founded The Guardian in 1901, and basically until his death in 1934, poured his own money and his family's money into keeping the weekly alive. And that attracted a population of African Americans and African descended people, not just in Boston, but really across the country, who were really looking for a newspaper, a weekly that spoke to their demands.
Right. When he started the paper, The Guardian, 1901, and the Jim Crow era was really taking hold. And one of the things that motivated him was his frustration with Booker T. Washington, the leader of the Tuskegee Institute, who was, you know, perhaps the best nationally known African-American leader, perhaps at least among whites. They had drastically different perspectives on the problems facing African-Americans. Just tell us a bit about their backgrounds and how it shaped their perspectives.
Yeah, so I always say this, you know, my worry when I was writing the book with my editor was that, you know, Booker T. Washington, I didn't want him to come across in this narrative as a villain. I really wanted him to come across as somebody who had this counter narrative of blackness and black American history and white racism than Trotter had and that most black people experience. So Booker T. Washington was born enslaved in Western Virginia. He grew up in a time right at the end of the Civil War when there's sort of immense racial violence across Western Virginia and Virginia. He eventually attended Hampton Institute, and he really had ambitions. Washington had ambitions to become an attorney, and he was approached by a white general who was the head of much of the educational building after the Civil War named Samuel Chapman Armstrong. And Armstrong really had a very specific belief on the potentials for both African Americans and for Native Americans. He really believed that they needed to work, that they needed to be wedded to the idea of labor, and that that would then lead to their rights eventually being rewarded through the political system. And so Washington came underneath Armstrong's influence. Armstrong basically offered Booker T. Washington to become head of a school that was just beginning called the Tuskegee Institute in Tuskegee, Alabama. And he sends Washington out there in the 1880s to build up this institution. And so to Washington's credit, he created an institution, Tuskegee Institute, that became the most institutionally powerful black organization in the South at the time, and became the one route to higher education that many black people, most black people in the Jim Crow South had at the time. And so he was president of Tuskegee, but through that he became much more. He wielded a lot of political power, if not influence. And so one of the reasons he was able to do this was the way that he spoke about white racial violence, in which he really believed that white racial violence, lynching, was the result not of white racism, but of black backwardness and a need for Black people to work and get educations. And so this really flew in the face of what Trotter knew, but also to Trotter's chagrin, it really flew in the face of what most Black people experienced. And so when Trotter started The Guardian, he really wanted to tap into the fact that although Washington had done much for education in the South, Washington had really become somebody who was, as Du Bois said, a leader of two races, not one. He really had to walk this fine line between support for the white racial regime in the South and support for his people. And Trotter would say, and the historical record would say, was that he failed in the latter point.
Another event that Trotter became deeply involved in was the release in 1915 of the film Birth of a Nation, which had all kinds of racist portrayals of African Americans during Reconstruction, portraying them played by white actors in blackface as, you know, aggressive and menacing, and it treats the Ku Klux Klan as a heroic force. What did Trotter do in response to the release of this film?
The Birth of a Nation came out in 1915. It was based on the series of books that were written by a segregationist in the early 1900s. They were extremely popular, those books. The film, when it came out, was the first long-form film and was hugely successful. It was the first time most Americans had seen a film as we would think of it today that has like a plot and it has actors and actresses and it has scenes and all that type of thing. So Trotter understood when it was released that this was going to shape the way that people understood politics and understood specifically the role of Black people in the Republic for generations to come, and that that was going to affect policy, how people passed laws, how people, you know, taught history in schools. And so he was adamant that the film was dangerous. And he actually was proven right. You know, we know that when the Birth of a Nation premiered in Georgia, that it gave rise to the new Ku Klux Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia in 1915. So he was not wrong. And he really believed that this film was not just about censorship. It was more about preventing this pervasive racist propaganda from slipping into the American society.
How did he organize around it?
Well, the first thing he did was he met with the governor of Massachusetts and the mayor of Boston to try to get the film banned. Ironically, this is at a time when Boston was known as a city that was puritanical in its beliefs on public entertainment. So they banned everything from, you know, classical music performances to, you know, stage plays. And so he was asking Boston to live up to that reputation and to ban the film. And of course, Boston refused to do so. And so he would stage mass protests in which Black people and some white allies would show up in the theaters and then disrupt the showing of the film. He staged a massive protest outside the Massachusetts State House in which he and members of the local NAACP met with the governor to try to get the film banned or get it censored. And when that didn't work, the crowd ended up going into movie theaters and preventing the film from being shown. So it really was this massive protest within the streets as well as protests through the courts.
After World War I, it was a time of enormous mob violence of whites against Blacks in many cities. Chicago, there was a huge riot. There was Tulsa, Oklahoma, where an entire community was destroyed. And Trotter came to embrace the idea of armed Black resistance. He helped form a group called the African Blood Brothership to advance that idea. What was the idea? What was its impact?
So Trotter, by 1919, during the horrible Red Summer of 1919, came to believe, like many of his younger supporters, that African Americans had to bear arms to protect themselves and their communities from what was a resurgence of violence. Elaine, Arkansas, Chicago, Boston, New York, all of these cities are just erupting in white violence against Black people, many of whom were still in their World War I uniform. So this is right after World War I. And so Trotter met with many of his allies who were socialists, Marxists, trade unionists, and began to really study this idea of the roles that violence and armed resistance could play in Black protest. He also began to read a lot of literature around anti-colonialism and the role of continental Africa's claims to power and resistance to colonial powers in Africa. And through that, he began to adopt this idea that Black people needed to arm themselves. He also took a lot of lessons from what was going on in Ireland in terms of people arming themselves against the British. And so he really saw this as part of a long tradition of oppressed people using their right to bear arms to rise up against their oppressors.
You know, it's interesting. You know, most of us don't know about him, and maybe that's partly because he didn't write a memoir and didn't give interviews much, and he didn't have children, so there weren't people writing about him. What is his legacy, his impact, do you think?
I think his impact is daring the Black community, both at home and I would argue globally, to decide for themselves and demand for themselves what liberation looks like, and not allowing outside people or even self-interested members of your own community dictate what liberation should look like. I think that's a very powerful way of looking at justice that someone like Trotter really introduced to his readers and definitely to the country.
Well, Carrie Greenidge, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, and this was lovely.
Carrie Greenidge is the author of Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davis.